You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of November, 2013, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Raffaello Pantucci from RUSI joins us to set the day's news agenda. Raffaello, what have you got for us today?
Today we're going to talk about why a Pakistani government is blocking NATO supply lines, why the West is giving $8 billion to the Sahel region of Africa, and how smog in China.
More from Raf a little later on in the show. Also on the program, Sundays to the rescue. The government in Athens reckons seven-day trading could just save the economy. We'll see if it's got any chance of success.
And we're in Turkey too to see how the country is struggling between tradition and modernity.
The word architect is actually used not only for designers but for many other people. I think we need to put aside these notions of auteurism in architecture and try to approach to what extent architects, designers, contractors, patrons work together.
We'll also find out why the US military are taking inspiration from a comic book hero.
I think the military is very interested in the protective capabilities that the suits have as far as people in combat and gunfire, and they see it as really a way to save lives.
If all of that wasn't enough, well, we'll check in with our man in Budapest too. We might even play some music. That is all coming up in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Police in New Jersey have sealed off a shopping centre in the town of Paramus after a gunman entered the building and fired several shots. So far, there are no reports of any casualties. This man, who was working in one of the stores in the centre, told local TV station WPIX what he saw.
It was a gunman that walked in through this California Pizza Kitchen. He's barely full body armor, rifle and everything. Walked right past the movers, told them, like, I'm not going to hurt you. Kept walking in, and then he walked all the way through towards the Nordstrom side, and that's where the gunshots were fired. We heard about two shots, and then the security guards started going past them, started walking towards them, and that's when basically started seeing all the evacuation, and then I started evacuating as many people as I could through the stores, and once that happened, we had all the cops like rushing here.
The United Nations says around 9.3 million Syrians, 40% of the country's population, now need outside assistance. In September, the figure stood at 6.8 million. The UN's humanitarian chief, Valerie Amos, told the Security Council that the crisis continues to deteriorate rapidly and inexorably. UN Arab League envoy Lakhdar Brahimi is in Geneva, where he's due to hold talks with US and Russian diplomats aimed at clearing the way for a Syria peace conference planned for later this month. The government of the Democratic Republic of Congo is claiming to have defeated M23 rebels who they'd been fighting in the east of the country. A spokesman said the last rebels had either surrendered or escaped across the border and their weapons had been destroyed. A rebel call for a truce had previously been rejected. M23 have so far not responded to the announcement. A teenage girl's recovering in a Sydney hospital after being shot in the back on Monday night in what police say was a botched, targeted attack. Police say up to three men visited a house in West Sydney and argued with the occupants. Shots were fired when they failed to gain entry. The 13-year-old girl was hit in the back by gunshot pellets that police say were intended for her brother. The Premier of New South Wales, Barry O'Farrell, was clearly angry at the uncooperative attitude of the girl's family.
Extraordinarily, her parents are not cooperating with police. What sort of parent, whose daughter's been injured in an attack like this, will not cooperate with police?
Indonesia's Foreign Minister Marty Natalegawa has warned that relations with Australia could be jeopardised without firm assurances on spying allegations. Indonesia summoned Australia's ambassador last Friday to explain media reports that the embassy in Jakarta was used to spy on the country as part of a US-led global spying network. The Sydney Morning Herald said the reports were based on information leaked by the US whistleblower Edward Snowden and a former Australian intelligence officer. Natalegawa said the response so far from Australia and the US has been vague.
In the absence of such assurances, to the contrary, then of course we must assume that such activities are taking place unless we are able to obtain explicit assurance that it is not taking place. At the very least, what we need to be ensured is that it will no longer take place in the future.
North Korea has revealed that one of its warships sank last month, killing a number of seamen. The admission came when state media reported that leader Kim Jong-un had visited a naval cemetery. He was photographed walking past a row of gravestones inscribed with the date 13th of October. The state news agency said submarine chaser number 233 had fallen while performing combat duties in mid-October. South Korean media reports say the sinking happened during an exercise off the east coast of the Korean Peninsula, and they've suggested that the age of the vessel could have been a factor. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Bonnie, are we allowed to make news requests?
I don't think you can make up the news.
I would like to report that a newsreader from West London has just won 50 million quid on the lottery.
It's a good story. What I mean is that at the end of the news, obviously you've got your news agenda, which you decide and we love it. But, you know, sometimes you have a light story at the end. And
there aren't many about.
I've seen a really good one that Platypuszilla.
Yeah, but that was around yesterday.
Oh, no. Sorry, Dom. I'm behind the curve on Platypus News.
I'll look into it.
If you could find a new line on Platypuszilla, I would be delighted. And that's a sort of trailer for the news.
Fair dinkum, mate.
Nice. Barney, thanks very much. Barney will be back with news of the giant platypus fossil in a little bit under half an hour. For the moment, it's 8:06 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London. Time now to set the day's news agenda. And joining us in the studio is Raffaella Pantucci, Senior Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute here in London. Welcome to the show, Raffaella. Where should we begin today?
Good morning. I think it's probably a good idea to start in Pakistan, in the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province in particular, which is a province which is predominantly governed by the party Tehreek-e-Insaf, which is the party that is ruled by Imran Khan, the famous former cricketer who married Jemima Khan for a while, who is now a sort of prominent politician in Pakistan, who has really taken the reins of the sort of anti-American strain you kind of get in Pakistani politics. And here what's happening is that his ruling party in this province have said that they're going to block NATO supply lines through the province to Afghanistan if drone strikes persist. This is in direct reaction to the droning earlier, it was last week now, of Hakimullah Massoud, the leader of the Tehreek-e-Taliban, in Pakistan. And I mean, for me, this is an interesting story, an important one, because, you know, it shows the incredible sort of duality of Pakistani politics and relationships with the US and in dealing with these insurgent groups. I mean, you know, the TTP, Hakimullah Massoud's group, was responsible certainly for more Pakistani deaths than drone strikes ever have been. And yet, you know, here you have this political party that is willing to make a political point to try to block, you know, NATO going through its province for the death of a man who has no friend of the state.
I mean, it's certainly a sort of headline-creating, wave-creating move, isn't it? And presumably everybody is watching Nawaz Sharif's reaction to see how he deals with this wave-generating.
Well, I mean, you've seen Nawaz Sharif himself has sort of, I think, avoided much comment about this particular incident, but we've seen some quite senior members of his administration come out in great, you know, anger and unction about this, you know, the yet another American drone strike against a good Pakistani citizen. And it's just this sort of extraordinary paradox you have in some of these things. I mean, if you go back a little bit and you could look at the case of Malala Yousafzai, the young girl who was shot in the head by the Taliban, you know, she is considered by some elements in the Pakistani press and in the Pakistani Comintern as an American stooge. And this is a 14-year-old girl who got shot in the head while she was trying to advance women's rights. And they will, you know, hagiographize a man who is responsible for, you know, thousands and thousands of deaths in the country. It's just, it really highlights, in fact, how chaotic the situation in Pakistan is. And in many ways, I think it's quite depressing because if you think, what have we been doing all this time in Afghanistan?
But the Pakistanis are going to argue that this is putting at jeopardy peace talks with the Taliban. That's their main concern. At least that's what they're putting forward, isn't it?
This is certainly the line that they're taking. And what's interesting, in fact, is that we've seen the President Hamid Karzai of Afghanistan has also said that he's somewhat concerned about this. But again, I think that people are playing a sort of dual game here. I mean, yes, Hakim al-Masud had started to talk to authorities. However, I don't think we should say that we had, you know, a peace agreement signed on the dotted line yet. I think from the Afghans' perspective, there was even some evidence that they were trying to reach out to the TTP, Hakim al-Masud's group, in an attempt to sort of create their own strategic depth into Pakistan, in the same way that they see the Pakistanis having strategic depth with their links to the Taliban into Afghanistan.
I mean, presumably one angle we're not seeing here is the possibility of the noise that's being caused on the ground in Pakistan by Imran Khan and others actually having any effect on the buttons that are being pressed from the Pentagon under Obama's direction. I mean, the policy on drone strikes isn't going to change, presumably.
No, I don't think so. But I think what is notable is that it has gone down. I mean, drone strikes, we used to be talking about them on a, you know, semi-weekly basis.
I noticed you used the word droning. I've never heard that. Droning as a verb. He was droned. He got droned. It's extraordinary.
Well, I think this is a new modern word to go with modern technology.
You know? I like it. Okay.
And Rafael, there's another story which you have highlighted for us. I remember last year, the UN Food Program tried to run a campaign called Save the Sahel. Yes. And now a year later, it looks like the World Bank and other countries are committing some $8 billion to the region.
Yeah, well, this is a sort of, this is the EU, the World Bank, and I believe even maybe the IMF are putting together an $8 billion aid package for the Sahel region. When we're talking about the Sahel, we're talking Burkina Faso, Mali, Mauritania, Niger, Senegal, and Chad. It's kind of that swathe of countries just below the sort of top range of North Africa. And this is a group which, this is a part of the world where, of course, Mali kind of sits at its heart. And we can think back to earlier this year with Operation Serval, when the French went into Mali to push out the Al-Qaeda-affiliated and Tuareg groups that had sort of slowly started taking over the country. And I think the point here is that, you know, we're talking about a very substantial aid package for a part of the world that, you know, often doesn't get much attention and only really gets our attention when disaster strikes. We saw in the In Amenas incident earlier this year in Algeria. This was groups who fundamentally come from this sort of little bracket of the world. And again, in Mali, a country that almost sort of collapsed. And we've seen incidents across the region in Niger and elsewhere. This is right across the border from the European Union. You know, we're crossing the Mediterranean. It's not a huge body of water that separates the two. And so, you know, it's good to see that we're actually seeing a substantial longer-term investment that's really focused on, you know, electricity generation, boosting irrigation, improving agriculture, not the only hard security sort of things.
But I suppose it's money can't necessarily be seen as the silver bullet in this, in that, I mean, one of the major factors of the instability that preceded the Mali situation was fighters emerging from Muammar Gaddafi's regime and sort of being dispersed there. So, I mean, presumably there's the idea that if these people exist willing to do that, then if there's aid put to that bit, then they'll move elsewhere. Is that feasible?
Well, that's certainly true. But, you know, that's one has to start somewhere. You know, you have to try to make some effort to improve the situation. And, you know, these the fighters you're talking about, the mobile the warriors who sort of left Gaddafi's armies to then go back to Mali and stir up the Tuareg insurrection there. I mean, they need to have a sort of angered populace that they can sort of swim amongst to, you know, launch their attacks. If that populace has, you know, more economic development, has, you know, a prospect of a better tomorrow, then it's possible that they will reject these sorts of influences.
And Raffaello, we've covered many times on this program the smog problem in China, but a horrific story of an 8-year-old girl now who's been diagnosed with lung cancer.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the South China Morning Post today has two big stories, depressing stories about smog in China. One is this 8-year-old girl in Jiangsu who has caught lung cancer. Well, you don't really catch lung cancer, do you? Who has developed lung cancer as a result of the terrible dust and particles in the city where she was living. And at the same time, up north in the city of Harbin, we have traffic police and authorities there have been unable to use their CCTV cameras because the smog is so bad that visibility is below 3 meters. I mean, you know, this is a story we bang on about endlessly with China. It's the sort of the breakneck, you know, pace of urban development and the sort of giant coal-fired factories that spew up, you know, all sorts of particles in the air. You know, and fundamentally, we all see China as our great, you know, manufacturing hub where we get all our stuff made. But I think there's a sort of human cost here that sometimes gets lost. And I think these ones really highlight how, you know, sad it can sometimes be.
Well, they certainly do. And the World Health Organization's been banging on about this, as you say, for some time, for sort of more than 3 years about this particular problem. I mean, I wonder, we talk about it here quite a bit. How sort of loudly is this conversation being had in China?
I mean, it is being had. And the thing is, you have to note that, you know, we often think that the Chinese government has a sort of total control of the situation and can close down any protests. What you do get is you do get a lot of these issues like this, very local environmental problems that do throw up a lot of anger amongst the local population and leads to all sorts of protests. I don't know if these two particular ones are going to lead to this. Well, certainly I don't think security authorities being unable to see with their cameras is going to anger many people. But, you know, it's possible. An 8-year-old girl, this sort of a figure could become a locally mobilizing figurehead.
Raffaello Pantucci, you are a senior research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, are you not?
I am indeed.
Excellent. Well, thank you for joining us with your job title, Raffaello. Always good to see you.
Always a pleasure.
Coming up after this very short break, Dominic, get ready. Get your wallets ready. We're going Sunday shopping
wallets.
In Greece.
I've only got one wallet. Well, you think I have two wallets?
Who knows? You're a rich man.
There's a monocle, no?
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to Midori House. It is 17 minutes past the hour here in London. Now, going shopping on a Sunday in Greece has traditionally been a pretty tricky exercise. Out of 52 possible Sundays in the year, Greek rules allow shops to open on precisely just two of them. It means that the Sunday trading laws out of Athens are amongst the most restrictive in Europe.
Indeed, but now lawmakers are reaching for Sunday store opening as the latest tool to try and jumpstart the ailing economy in Greece. Another day's shopping opportunity, it's hoped, will boost consumer spending. The changes to the regulations are already proving divisive, though. Lots of employees are concerned that family life is being sacrificed in favour of the economy. So, will it be worth it? And how's it going to work? Well, Christos Konstas is the chief business editor at Ependetis, and Peter Gumbel is a journalist and author based in Paris. They both join us on the line now. Welcome to the programme. Christos, if we can start with you, sketch out for us exactly what these plans are. What's new about what's being proposed?
Well, the sacred cow finally was sacrificed. The Sunday holiday was first established in Greece in 1908, and since then stores have been only opened on Sundays during the holiday periods. Now, the government and traders agreed for shops to be free to open on 7 Sundays each year. And this last Sunday was a beautiful sunny Sunday. People crowded the streets, consumer traffic at stores in Greece last Sunday, at least in the main shopping areas, turned out to be greater than expected. It was an experiment that turned out to be good. Of course, this doesn't solve the financial and economic problems of each family. It's not that we became rich suddenly because we open on Sundays, but still, things are looking better. The city center were vivid. It was a good example. In the three largest cities of the country, that is Athens, Thessaloniki, and Piraeus, shops were open for the first time, depending on decisions by the local commerce associations. That was the idea. I spoke with the chairman of the Association of Retail Enterprises in Greece, Mr. Makris. He said that compared to the same Saturday last year, where there was no Sunday opening, the visits to shopping centers went up this year by 300%. I repeat, 300%. And the turnover during this weekend was up between 50 and 100% on that Saturday compared to the last year Saturday. On the other hand, small retail stores are reporting a very different picture. They had a significant number of shoppers coming in, but turnover was far from satisfactory.
Absolutely. And Christos, many of those small stores are saying that having to open on Sunday will just add to the cost of operating these stores. And surely the main issue here is not about whether the shops are opening on Sunday or not. It's about whether Greeks have the money to spend that extra money on Sunday shopping. And as we know, the situation in Greece is very dire indeed.
Well, first of all, the shops are not obliged to open. It's not compulsory. They are free to open, but it's not compulsory. Some of the shops, as it turns out, they will open only on weekends because then they have more customers coming in. For example, in the areas nearby the sea, in a beautiful Sunday afternoon with the sun shining, 25 degrees, people go on the beach, they have their dinner or their lunch there, and they go shopping, they have fun. There is no need for these shops to open on Monday morning or a Tuesday morning. They better work on a Sunday. On the other hand, we are trying to boost the economy. One of the ways to do it is to boost tourism. Now, we have this idea of city breaks in Greece, and all the data shows that the charter flights from abroad and are continuing to arrive this month, October, in a huge numbers. So we think that if tourists come here for a weekend in Greece, in Athens, in Piraeus, in Thessaloniki, in other cities, they don't expect to find the shop. The shops closed. They want to shop. They want to go have fun. The number of holiday makers that arrive now in Greece is 30% higher in certain areas than was last year. I repeat, 30%. So again, the shops are not obliged to open. The shops are free to open. There is also, but I have to mention that, there is a problem with the workers in the shops, the people working in the shops. We have to safeguard their rights. They cannot work more than 40 hours per week. That is the law here, and we have to apply that law.
But and there are concerns as well, I believe, Christos. Sorry to cut you off. Concerns about the impact on family life as well, I believe. I want to bring in Peter Gumbel, if I can, for a slightly different European perspective. Peter, thanks for joining us. You're going to talk to us about the situation in France. That's a nation that's dabbled with changing the rules on Sunday trading itself. How's it worked out?
Well, actually, what's happening in France is it's going exactly the opposite direction from Greece. In the sense that in France there is a fairly rigid set of rules, but then there are lots of exceptions, and some of the big stores in some of the most touristy areas have been allowed to open later or open on Sundays. And what's been happening in the last year has been that the unions, the labor unions, have been waging a very, very tough legal campaign against all the exemptions they can find, which they think are in breach of the law, and they've actually managed to have court rulings which prevent some of the big chains, like the cosmetics chain Sephora, there's Uniqlo, there's Monoprix, there's even the Apple store, from opening late in the evenings or on Sundays. So we're going the opposite direction from Greece in France. And this is a very controversial issue because people are saying, wait a minute, we've got an economic crisis, we've got high unemployment, and there are a lot of people who are working late or had been working in the evenings or had been working on Sundays and earning extra money, earning overtime, and they're all complaining that they're out of a job now. So it's a very heated debate here in France, and there's going to be a decision probably by the end of the year. There's a commission that's looking at this question and looking at all the exemptions and looking at the rules, and they will probably come up with some Solomonic ruling about who can open when. But just, I think what's interesting is that if you look across Europe, shopping is still very, very regulated in many countries. The number of hours you're allowed to work and be open, even things like sales, when you can have sales, or how much you can discount, things like that. So we're still in many parts of Europe, unlike the UK, for example, in a situation where regulation is extremely, extremely rigid.
Absolutely, Peter. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Peter Gumbel, a journalist and author based in Paris. Before that, we heard from Christos Constance, chief business editor at Appenditis. Thanks for joining us.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
It's 9:25 in Budapest, 8:25 a.m. here in London, and it is time to go to Budapest. Our correspondent there is Adam Labor. Adam, how are you?
Good morning. I'm fine, thank you.
Excellent. Good to talk to you as ever. Let's start with a statue that's causing quite a lot of outrage where you are.
Yes, there's a statue of Admiral Miklós Horthy, who was Hungary's leader from 1920 to 1944 and an ally of Hitler during the Second World War, put Hungary on the side of the Axis, has gone up in a church in downtown Budapest, and it's causing a big stir.
What's the reaction been?
Well, people are very upset and angry and outraged, and the government too has condemned it. But as it's gone up within the territory of a church that's very strongly allied to the Jobbik far-right party, there's really not can be done because it's private property. I went to have a look at it yesterday, and there is Admiral Horthy, a bust of him, encased in a glass box, but it's not on the street. It's within the entrance of the church.
Do we know whether people, you know, you mentioned it is on private property, it is in a private church. Is there anything that authorities can do to try to remove this? And of course, Hungary has long dealt with its World War II history when it comes to its Hungarian Jewish population. Some 500,000 Jews were deported from the country. So obviously a very delicate issue for that nation.
Yes, I mean, it seems legally that there's nothing that can be done. And arguably, in a way, the law is not really the way to deal with this. If people want to put up a bust of Admiral Horthy on their private property, you know, you can say they have a perfect right to do so. But the fact is, he was Hungary's leader in 1944 when the Germans invaded, and the Hungarian government remains in some measure of control. And in the summer of 1944, during May and June, as you say, almost 500,000 Jews were sent to Auschwitz while he remained still sitting in Buda Castle, and the full force of the Hungarian state under his jurisdiction was deployed to put them on the trains, to draw up the lists, to build the ghettos, and to send them to be exterminated. So he bears a large measure of responsibility for that. He did nothing to try and slow or stop the deportations, didn't protest against them. Now, his defenders say that he did save many of the Jews of Budapest, and it's true that later on in 1944, when Adolf Eichmann wanted to deport the Jews of Budapest, Horthy stopped it. But then that raises the question is, why didn't he stop the deportation of the Jews of the countryside?
Adam, I want to talk about a story which has landed on the shores of Germany, on the shores of France, and it looks like the long fingers of the NSA may or may not have landed in Hungary too.
Yes. Budapest's always been a traditional listening post into Eastern Europe, like its neighbour Vienna. It's a city with a rich history of espionage and spying. Now, it seems, according to a WikiLeaks document, that the NSA and other various organs of the American government may have had a listening post in Hungary where they were eavesdropping, of course, on Hungary and its neighbours. And that's caused a lot of outrage here as well. And the government is demanding explanations. But, you know, with these things, it's rather like, you get the sense, it's rather like Angela Merkel saying, oh, I'm shocked to learn that you've been listening to my phone, but really, behind the scenes, let's keep on our intelligence cooperation.
And Adam, a final story that you've highlighted for us. Last week on this program, we were covering the prospects of a global wine shortage, but it looks like some technology might be helping out Hungarian wine growers.
Yes, the great Hungarian wine of which was drunk even by French kings hundreds of years ago is called Tokaj, from the east of the country. And the great thing about Tokaj is that it has something called noble rot, which is when the grapes kind of wither on the vine to concentrate the sugar, because Tokaj is mostly a dessert wine. And now a lot of new technology is coming in, which is helping really check the humidity and the sunlight and the way that the vine is growing to really boost up the way that noble rot is encouraged to grow. So it looks like, you know, in Hungary at least, there's not going to be any wine shortage for some time.
Good news for all of us wine lovers out there. Adam Labor in Budapest, thanks for joining us today on the program.
So that's the halfway mark. It's the halfway mark in today's show, Phil. How do you feel it's gone so far?
Really well, I think. Yeah, you've done well. I'm impressed.
You're giving me a good report. Yeah. Oh, thanks
Sometimes
very much.
Sometimes a bit, you know.
Okay, I'll give you your report off air. In the next half hour of the show, even more to come. We're going to be hearing about some controversial Ottoman architecture. We will be reviewing the Italian front pages. Monocle's David Pleasant will be here to help us do that. And we will also be finding out about the superhero Iron Man and how he might just be about to become a reality.
I think the military is very interested in the protective capabilities that the suits have as far as people in combat and gunfire. And they see it as really a way to save lives.
But before that, here's Barney Burnham with your headlines.
Thanks, Tom. Police in New Jersey have sealed off a shopping centre in the town of Paramus after a gunman entered the building and fired several shots. So far, there are no reports of any casualties. The United Nations says around 9.3 million Syrians, 40% of the population, now need outside assistance. In September, the figure was 6.8 million. The UN's humanitarian chief, Valerie Amos, has told the Security Council that the crisis continues to deteriorate. The government of the Democratic Republic of Congo is claiming to have defeated M23 rebels who'd been fighting against them in the east of the country. A spokesman said the last rebels had either surrendered or escaped across the border and their weapons had been destroyed. A teenage girl's recovering in a Sydney hospital after being shot in the back in what police say was a botched, targeted attack. The girl's parents are refusing to cooperate with police. Indonesia's foreign minister has warned that relations with Australia could be jeopardised without firm assurances on spying allegations. Indonesia summoned the Australian ambassador last Friday to explain media reports that the embassy in Jakarta was used to spy on the country as part of a US-led global spying network. North Korea has revealed that one of its warships sank last month, killing a number of seamen. The admission came when leader Kim Jong-un was photographed at a naval cemetery walking past a row of gravestones inscribed with the date 13th of October. And finally, as requested by Mr. Reynolds, scientists in Queensland say they've unearthed part of a giant platypus fossil. The creature, which they believe would have been more than a metre long, at least twice as large as the modern platypus, has been named Platypuszilla. There you have it. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Oh, it was worth it, wasn't it?
You're very happy, aren't you?
Oh, Platypuszilla. It's twice as big as a normal platypus, at least.
It reminded me of someone I once knew.
Well, looking at this fossil, I'm slightly worried about that. Did this person have an amazingly long beak?
I should protect their feelings.
Okay, well, Barney, thank you very much. I like all requests and finally news.
It's nice, isn't it?
I think we should do that more often. Barney, thanks very much indeed. You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24, with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Phil Hahn. Now, during the 19th century, one family dominated architecture in Istanbul, the Balians. They were Ottoman Armenians, originally from East Anatolia, and three generations of the family built some of the most famous landmarks in the Ottoman Empire's capital city.
Now, their work has stood as a testament to the Ottomans' embrace of westernization and to the contribution the empire's non-Muslim subjects made to imperial society. But some say they weren't actually architects at all. The controversy speaks to the bias, nationalism, and poor understanding that has plagued historical scholarship of Ottoman architecture for more than a century. Caleb Lau reports for this week's edition of Section D.
The sound of construction is the sound of Istanbul. Today, names like Doğuş, Ağlu, Limak, and Cengiz dominate the trade, reshaping Turkey's biggest city. But in the 19th century, one family, the Balians, dominated the city's landscape. Many of the family's most impressive works sit on the banks of the Bosphorus Strait.
Dear passenger, Bosphorus tour is on the 10th right.
Ferries on the famous waterway, carrying tourists, commuters, and even buskers working the decks, glide past the palaces, mosques, and barracks built by the Balians. Members of the Balyan family served the Ottoman sultans in various capacities, from the start of the 18th century to the end of the 19th, advising on and administering imperial construction, architecture, and urban planning.
I like the Ortaköy Mosque the most.
Alison Wharton teaches at Mardin University and wrote her PhD dissertation on the Balyan family.
It's architecturally very interesting because the exterior of the mosque is actually curving, physically curving, as opposed to being a kind of solid vertical or horizontal plane. I think they were looking to Renaissance architecture, and it's quite similar to a building in Venice that may have been a model. Also, I like the dome, the trompe l'oeil, the illusionistic paintwork of the dome, because if you look just briefly, you think it's a copy of a Renaissance work, and then if you look more carefully, then you can see all these Islamic elements in it. Like, you can see there's a whole line of mihrabs, which was obviously like a major theme of Islamic art and architecture, and then there's 8-pointed stars and other motifs. So yeah, I think it's interesting that if you look closer, you see all these hidden sort of messages in it. So if you look generally, you think just, ooh, Westernization, you know, this is copying European Renaissance or Baroque, and then if you look more closely, you can see the Ottoman elements of it.
This grappling of the Ottoman identity with Western influences is, in many ways, the essence of the story of the Balyans. And it happened within the broader context of the Ottoman state trying to modernize and meet the challenge of rising Western Europe. Despite reforms and innovations, the empire continued to lose wars and territory and ultimately legitimacy in the eyes of many of its subjects. The story of decline came to overshadow the story of modernization. And those that had embraced or brought home Western influences got a bad name. In particular, the Balyans began to be blamed for corrupting and mongrelizing Ottoman architecture.
They're described as people who have this promiscuous drive for imitation. They're considered to be cultural compradors who are subservient to the will of hegemonic Western forces.
Ahmet Ersoy teaches history at Boğaziçi University in Istanbul and is spending a year at Harvard, from where he spoke to me by phone.
We can say that largely this, you know, nationalist bias has excluded the input and the agency of non-Muslim actors in the Ottoman field.
The story of the Balyans in particular came to be divided between what might be called the Armenian perspective and the Ottoman or Turkish nationalist perspective.
Basically, the Armenian account is focused on the biographies of the Balyan family. From the Armenian perspective, they overemphasize their creativity. They stress that they graduated from architecture in the Collège Saint-Barbe, which never even had an architecture department, for instance. So they're really, really over-egging this kind of artistic genius figure thing.
The Ottoman or Turkish nationalist perspective is very different.
Ermeniler böyle bir şey hiçbir zaman düşünmediler. Sorun şuydu.
Seliman Can teaches in the Art History Department of Marmara University. He argues that there is insufficient evidence to claim that the Balyan family were actually architects, but were instead more simple, and often corrupt, construction magnates. Can argues that the archives suggest the actual architects of many quote-unquote Balyan works were actually Muslim. So, on the one hand, the Balyans have been held up as symbols of the deep Armenian contribution to Ottoman society. And there is a tragic irony looming in this view. Despite their contribution, in the empire's last years, Armenians suffered the ultimate persecution. On the other hand, scholars like Seliman Can say the Balyans' reputation is undeserved, even fraudulent, and has obscured Muslim contributions in the field. But it's not a question of which view is right and which is wrong. The problem is that the actual history is poorly understood, and because of this, the story is vulnerable to retellings based on pride, guilt, and bias. Getting to the bottom of things may require sorting out basic vocabulary. For example, the word architect may confuse more than it reveals.
Because we're talking about a very, very active, competitive construction sector in the 19th century. Not only architects themselves, but patrons, bureaucrats, designers, constructors, contractors, subcontractors, financiers, and a whole array of networks and alliances that bring these people together. And the word architect, mimar, which is also used in modern Turkish, is actually used not only for designers, but for many other people involved in the basic, you know, from menial jobs in the construction site to investors and contractors. I think we need to put aside these notions of authorism in architecture and try to approach to what extent architects, designers, contractors, patrons work together in the design and construction process. You know, the Balyans seem to be very, very important, prominent figures in the architectural field who coordinated most of these projects. But as yet, we still have to decipher the codes of their engagement and participation in these projects. So there's a good deal of ambiguity in that regard.
And there are many other unanswered questions.
The most interesting thing for me is their politics, actually, because I never got to the bottom of it.
Historians will eventually tell us why the Balyan family enterprise suddenly dried up in the late 1890s, and what the evidence has to say about Serkis Balyan, the last prominent Balyan, and whether he was involved in Armenian separatist politics. But for now, the challenge is more fundamental: to build up a body of critical scholarship on a remarkable family and its relationship to a city's remarkable architecture. For Monocle, in Istanbul, I'm Caleb Lauer.
Dominic, stop dancing. We're back to work. You can hear more of that program. That, of course, is this week's edition of Section D, which airs at 1900 hours London time. That's 8 a.m. in Auckland and 1400 hours in New York.
You are listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a look at how the superhero Iron Man could apparently soon be a reality in the U.S. military.
The perfect way to start the day on the East Coast or in Latin America, your lunchtime catch-up in Europe, The Briefing is Monocle 24's fast-paced news and business show, bringing you up to speed with all the day's biggest stories.
It is absolutely vast. It's palatial in its proportions, this building, and it really reflects just how important the role of Mayor of Paris is.
Monocle's team of in-house experts bring you all the latest news on media and aviation, defence and technology, while an editor is on hand to run through the morning's front pages from Bogota to Boston.
You have all these people scrambling, you have all these investigators involved, and we still don't have a clear reason as to why these batteries did what they did.
My feeling is that politicians eat and try to enrich themselves and tax us.
That's The Briefing, every weekday at midday in London and 7 a.m. in New York, in association with BlackBerry.
Do you ever survey a parade of shops and gathered locals and wonder why the scene is so inviting? Well, to find out, Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé ventured to Wilton Way, a small thoroughfare in East London's Hackney, to get a read on the ingredients that underpin a community.
In a former post office at number 67, Borough Wines is a perfect example of modern renewal born out of village ideals. The success of Muriel Chatel's Hackney Wine Shop is down to the daily engagement with the locals. In addition to the expertly chosen bottles on the shelves, Borough Wines provides a fill-your-bottle-at-the-barrel service offering simply one red, one white, and one rosé at a comforting price.
You can watch Tyler Brulé's Hackney Revival film in the programmes menu on monocle.com.
You are listening to Midori House, where the time is 8:43 a.m. here in London. Now, it seems that Iron Man, yep, you know Iron Man, star of three rather loud films, might soon become a reality, stepping off the screen indeed. The comic book hero has become a source of inspiration for the U.S. military, who are hoping to produce a prototype of a protective, in inverted commas, Iron Man suit.
Well, get your costumes out, because the suit, which is called the Tactical Assault Light Operator Suit, not a handful at all, will incorporate a number of exciting features that could give special operation fighters greater protection, allowing a soldier to move more quickly while carrying heavy weapons, as well as downloading live video data from drones. Well, to find out more, Monocle's Barbara Feeney spoke to Justin Bachman, an associate editor at businessweek.com. Barbara began by asking why the U.S. military have decided to mimic some of the features from Mark's series of suits in the Iron Man comics and movies.
I think the military is very interested in the protective capabilities that the suits have as far as people in combat and gunfire, and they see it as really a way to save lives.
Are they actually modeling the suit on what's in the movies, or, you know, tell me a little bit more.
I think the movie may be a stretch too far in terms of the technologies that are available, but, you know, the basic concept of, you know, armor that could protect from gunfire, shrapnel, and certain types of explosions could definitely, you know, come from the suit. I think one thing that won't be happening anytime soon is flight that you see in the movies. This is more of an effort for, you know, defensive capabilities and getting a lot of technologies in one area that you could incorporate into a suit that has some similarities. But I think the movie is definitely more Hollywood than they can go for.
Can you explain a little bit further about some of the features that we would see in this type of suit?
Yeah, one area that they're definitely interested in would be the surveillance, as far as having a live video capabilities from like a surveillance drone that could send video to the person wearing the suit to see what's happening, as well as, you know, monitoring from the suit data on temperature and environment and making sure that the wearer is comfortable and not in any type of distress or injuries. You know, also to find if there's a way to, if you were in a situation with poison gas or some other type of environmental problem, that the suit would actually, you know, have oxygen and you would be able to continue doing what you needed to be doing.
These features, it does sound like the suit could assist the people like the U.S. Special Operations Forces in their work. Is it practical in terms of the cost and in terms of the time frame they've set for producing this suit?
Well, that's probably the real main question here is what would this cost? And there have been no financial sums that anybody has discussed. I think what they're interested in seeing right now is what technologies are available and what would actually work in a combat situation. And at that point, is it something that could be done feasibly to have, you know, more than one suit? I mean, because it's great to have a concept. I think, you know, probably anybody could say, yeah, if cost were no object, here's what could be done tomorrow. But at the same time, I think given the U.S. government's financial duress that, you know, there's probably some thought to, we like the idea, but it's got to be affordable.
So in that sense, financially, the suit would probably only be made for certain forces within the military.
I doubt that this device would be something that you would see, you know, widely deployed for thousands and tens of thousands of people in the military. But, you know, for certain situations where, you know, you're in a, you know, situation where, you know, there's definite combat and gunfire, I think that they would love to be able to have some of these and go into places where right now it's definitely a threat.
And has there been much interest in terms of the production of this suit? Have there been many companies who have posed interest?
Yeah, I think there is a lot of interest by a lot of smaller tech startups that, you know, have certain technologies that could come into play, whether it's robotics or like an exoskeleton type device where you could lift far more weight than a human could on his own. But a lot of smaller firms, as well as Raytheon, one of the biggest defense contractors, is interested. They have an exoskeleton technology that I think that they're trying to get the military folks interested in.
And finally, Justin, have we seen anything similar like this being produced before? What have you seen?
There are on YouTube a number of videos of sort of a device that would attach to, you know, arms and legs that I've seen companies that are like an exoskeleton type technology to let people maneuver faster or to carry weights. But I think getting it all together is probably not been attempted before. If you want to talk about communications and the armor protection and the climate control and the load-bearing weight capabilities, I think putting it all together is what's really new. And the question is, you know, how quickly can it be done and at what sort of cost?
Do you feel those sound effects were slightly misleading, Phil?
I like them.
I do. I mean, I'm really excited about it. I mean, I feel like the answer is it's not quite going to happen just yet. It's not quite like the movie.
We need a Tony Stark.
We need a Tony
Someone
Stark.
To revolutionize the industry.
That's it.
Someone who has the passion, the ideas, the big concepts.
Sounds like you're auditioning.
Yeah.
Okay. Justin Bachman was the man providing the info there. He's associate editor at businessweek.com, and he was speaking to our own Barbara Feeney.
Well, in just a moment, we'll be reviewing this morning's Italian front pages with Monocle researcher David Pleasant. But first, here is Mattia Bazar with Ti Sento. And that was Mattia Bazar there with Ti Sento.
Yes, it was. Now it's 9.53 in Milan, 8.53 here in London. It's time to review this morning's newspapers from a particular part of the world. And given that David Pleasant's here, I guess that part of the world is Italy. Am I right?
It is, Dom.
Yes.
Hello.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Excellent. So you have La Repubblica in front of you.
That's right. And it's this story is what's kind of leading on most of the dailies. The ongoing saga of the Interior Minister, Anna Maria Cancellieri, who, not Interior Minister, I correct myself, Justice Minister.
There's live translation going on here, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
We forgive you. We forgive you.
She is in a lot of trouble for organising the release of an inmate from prison who happened to be the daughter of somebody, an associate of hers. She told the Rai State TV on Saturday that she made a humanitarian intervention based on the possibility that the inmate could have died. That's not good enough for
a lot
of...
It doesn't look good, does it?
Well, it depends what kind of side of the fence you're on about, you know, the humanitarian treatment of prisoners. This is a little bit contentious in Italy. There's a lot of debate about prison conditions. The EU has given Italy quite a large fine or threatened Italy with a big fine over the overcrowding of its prisons. And Cancellieri has been a proponent of the amnesty that the president condoned to basically get rid of about a half of Italy's inmates. All at once. So it's pretty contentious.
But if you go deep into this, a bit deeper on a couple other levels, it's interesting because the family of Ligresti and Cancellieri are longtime friends, aren't they? And Cancellieri's son earned millions of dollars in payments from this insurance magnate. This is obviously going to, you know.
Exactly. So, I mean, obviously, it's not for us to judge. And,
Phil is
the judge, jury, and executioner here.
Laying the facts out.
The law of Phil has found you guilty, I'm afraid. Sorry.
And it's also a great shame for Letta, the Prime Minister. Cancellieri is seen as one of his key kind of supporters. And she's quite an influential figure herself. She's deemed a kind of intellectual, very kind of reasoning, levelling force in Italian politics, someone of substance. So for this to happen to her, it is quite a shock and is taking up a lot of headspace all over the papers.
Certainly lots of column inches I can see being devoted to it. What else is making the news in Italy?
I thought we'd then go right down to the south, to Messina, the Sicilian city of Messina, where its mayor, Renato Acorinti, has caused a lot of controversy over his use of the peace flag. If visitors to Italy might be familiar with the rainbow flag that's actually adopted as the peace flag, pace flag, for a few decades now. That was adorned on the main war memorial of the city of Messina. And also this came on National Armed Forces Day, Italy's equivalent of Remembrance Sunday. Very provocative move by a pacifist, openly pacifist mayor that was voted in last year in a wave of independent election victories all over Sicily.
And so what's been the reaction to this? What sort of pressure is he under?
Well, one of the ministers in the Ministry of Public Administration that also deals with the armed forces, spending-wise, has called this a demented gesture and is saying that this is kind of a step too far, no matter how, what your kind of political views, that this shows no respect for Italy's armed forces. And the mayor retaliated by saying, by quoting some of the figures on national poverty in Italy and saying that the armed forces cost the nation 21 billion euros per year when there's 15% of the population in poverty.
Interesting little sort of microcosm of a wider debate there. And, just as a side point, I'm a big fan of the word demented. I like people using the word demented. I think it's
I've been called demented a few times.
Yeah. Well, David, before we let you go, you're off to Turin, Italy tomorrow, aren't you, for a bit of a Monocle film project. Do you want to give us a sneak peek?
A trailer. Sure. Well, Turin's a fantastic centre for design. Some people say it even kind of rivals Milan. So we're going to be looking at the kind of domestic design scene in Italy. What makes it such a kind of flourishing, nurturing ground for some of Italy's best designers?
Excellent stuff, David.
Well, sounds dementedly exciting.
Safe travels. Unfortunately, though, that is all the time we have for today's programme. Thanks to our producer, Barbara Fini, our researcher, Fernando Costa Pacheco, and Andrea Alacone, and a very talented and steadfast studio manager, Chris Chilvers. Up next after the news is The Entrepreneurs with Sophie Grove. Stay tuned for the briefing at midday in London, 7 a.m. in New York. I'll be back with Tag Enright from Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Dominic Reynolds. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Hong Kong, Zurich,
Zurich.
London. Londres.
This is Monocle 24.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists across seven disciplines and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. For Rolex, it's a chance to ensure the world's artistic legacy is passed on to the next generation. One year can inspire a lifetime.